This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. You Are My Destiny was one of many songs that made our next guest, Paul Anka, a teen idol in the late 50s and early 60s. He wrote most of his hits. Not only You Are My Destiny, but Diana, Put Your Head on My Shoulder, and Puppy Love. Later, he wrote the song that became Frank Sinatra's anthem, My Way. And at Johnny Carson's request, wrote the theme for The Tonight Show that accompanied Carson for 30 years. Last year, Paul Anka released his latest CD, Classic Songs, My Way. Earlier this summer, Paul Anka received the Johnny Mercer Award at the 2008 Songwriters Hall of Fame dinner for his career body of work. In 2005, when Terry spoke with him, Paul Anka had just released a CD on which he sang other people's songs, songs few people expected he'd care about. That CD, called Rock Swings, features swing versions of rock songs from the 1980s and 90s by bands like R.E.M., The Pet Shop Boys, Van Halen, and Nirvana.
One of the songs you do on the new CD is Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit, you know, probably their most famous record. Mm-hmm. What did you hear in this as a potential swing song?
Well, it started with the assessment of the charts. When I looked at all the Billboard, you know, I saw the importance of grunge, you know, that whole Seattle movement. The Nirvana record is an anthem. He's a poet in a sense. You know, I understood it intellectually and where it was coming from. But when I looked at it, I said, you know, wouldn't it be wild if I could find the groove for this? Because I saw it right away in its melody structure. As a musician, I saw da 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 ba ba da ba. It does swing. The only thing I had to get over was to assess, you know, lyrically, how much of it, because I left a lot of the song out, how much was I going to use? How did it lay into this real swing shout that is probably one of the best swing shouts on the whole CD are those two instrumental releases. You know, I heard that, and that really hooked me. So I really selected the lyric that when I sung it would be at least believable enough for me once I got it into the pocket. But I knew it was an important challenge. I knew the importance of the group, and I just had to do it. And I've since heard from Dave Grohl, who's with the Foo Fighters, who was a part of the band, and he heard it. He heard me do it on Letterman, and then he heard the record, and he said, man, you know, I didn't recognize that lyric for about 20 seconds, but what a classic and great arrangement and the treatment. He went on and on about it. The reason I say that is because I felt in my heart that, you know, we're all creative people here. We're all part of that mosaic. And if I can create that and take a song that, you know, no one felt really had a chance to go there and really impress one of the guys that wrote it or that was a part of it, then my job is complete. And I've made a huge point there as to not pigeonhole that a good song's a good song.
Well, why don't we hear the original Nirvana version back-to-back with your new swing version of Smells Like Teen Spirit.
sucked, less dangerous. Here we are now. Entertain us. I feel stupid, contagious. Here we are now. Entertain us. I'm a lotto, an albino, a mosquito, my libido. Yeah. I'm worse at what I do best. And for this
gift, that was Smells Like Teen Spirit, performed first by Nirvana and then by Paul Anka, as featured on Paul Anka's CD, Rock's Wings. Oh, Paul Anka, the problem with that lyric as a swing song, and mm-hmm. and I know other people have pointed this out too, is you know you don't really hear the lyric that clearly on the original mm-hmm. record, but when you sing a mulatto, an albino, a mosquito, my libido, yeah. It's mm-hmm. just, I don't know that the lyric is meant to be heard that clearly or kind of swung that way. How did you feel, what did you do to try to make that part of the lyric work for you?
Well, I think the key is it is what it is. You know, you can look at abstract art or poetry or of any kind, and, you know, you have to respect, you know, the person that created it. Originally on the original record, you know, the way they mix those records, it's not necessarily let's hide the lyric. The fact is, it is the lyric to the song, and I think that those that grew up with the song, hearing it this way, not unlike taking a film from way back and modernizing it, it's the same analogy. You can't go changing the lyric, but there are people that have identified with it, that understood the original record, and that, you know, you can't sit down and hand out a pamphlet every time you record something as to what it means or what you mean by it. It is what it is. It swings. Those are the words. And if it's poetry in a sense, take it for what it is.
Your first hit when you were 16 was Diana, which was produced by Don Costa, who later mm-hmm. became Frank Sinatra's arranger and producer. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he'd been doing arrangements for Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. How did you meet Don Costa?
Well, I left Canada, where I was living at the time, and I wanted to get to New York. I'd already been there prior to meeting Don Costa because I knew that's where the music was. I won a contest collecting soup wrappers for Campbell's Soup. There was an ad in the paper for IGA Food Stores, and it said that if you collected these soup wrappers and put your name behind, put it in the box, that you could be selected, on and on and on. So I won. I got a job at IGA, clocked all the cans leaving, went to the houses. Anyway, I win from my district.
Wait. So you got this job just so you could collect more soup cans?
Uh-huh.
Wow. That's so ambitious.
I was a very ambitious young man. And I won the contest, and I went to New York with 40 other guys from Canada and a little box lunch, went to the YMCA. They put us up, and I really got a sense of the scene down there, Alan Freed, the rock and roll, everything that was happening. So I knew I had to get back there. I had some friends of mine who had a hit record at ABC Paramount called The Rover Boys, a song called Graduation Day, and they steered me over to
Was
that
We'll
Costa.
Remember Always Graduation Day?
Uh-huh. It was a big hit back then. And I was a fan of the Rover Boys, as I was for the Crew Cuts and Four Lads. So I went up to see Don Costa, and he saw this young kid walk in, you know, T-shirt, jeans, in a time when, you know, that wasn't the thing. It's not, you know, like it is today, where you've just got this rash of kids running around making records. And he said, "You okay, play me something," because they were a new company. And I sat down and just started banging away at the piano, and I played Diana and Don't Gamble With Love and a couple other songs, and that's where it all started. He, you know, said, "Where's your parents?" "In Canada. Can we fly them down?" Blah, blah, blah. And we signed a contract, and that was the beginning for me. I never went back.
Okay, the song Diana, the lyric is, "I'm so young and you're so old.
You're
this
so
is my
old.
Darling," I've been told. I've read this was basically about your babysitter.
Well, she sat a couple of times for my brother and sister, but she wasn't on an ongoing basis. She was someone I saw at church. You know, new in the community, small community, Ottawa, mm-hmm. Canada. And I saw her from afar most of the time, and then I would, you know, run into her socially at certain gatherings. But back in the 50s, unlike today, you know, if you were older by a few years, if you were taller, if you didn't have a shot. You know, that's what it was back then. And she was all of those things. And but I had this little crush on her, and thus I'm so young and you're so old. I would play it at parties for my friends. The word would leak out to her, and she thought it was rather cute. I mean, there was no real spiking of emotion there. And I just went on with it, and I'd put it in my pocket and just kept writing until I had the chance to. You know, originally I started playing those songs for these groups that would come to town, including Chuck Berry, and nobody really paid any attention to me. And that kind of really motivated me to go on and sing my own songs. And that was my first record.
Why don't we play it? This is from 1957, Paul Anka singing his song, Diana. Did you start thinking about how you were going to make the transition to adult music? And again, just to go back to the 50s and early 60s, it's a time when a lot of adults in the record industry were thinking rock and roll is this like passing phase, and it's not going to last. And a lot of like young rock and rollers are being groomed to play the copa because mm-hmm. they were going to become adults soon, and they had to make that transition to the adult audience. So what did you think your life would be like as an adult, and what kind of transition did you think you would have to make?
Well, somewhere around 58, 59, I realized that, I was changing and I had to change. I was looking for longevity, and, one has to realize that back then, rock as we know it today, or when it really started in let's say the mid-60s, and you had the Beatles with that form of rock and roll, which was light in 64. Prior to that, there was nothing else around except the Rat Pack. So it was all Frank Sinatra, that kind of music, and oops, who are these little kids with this kind of music that no one liked, including Sinatra. We started saying to ourselves, well, where do we go from here? I mean, look at those guys. They're so cool. I mean, they worked that place, Las Vegas and the Copa, and, we want to be like them. And I'd sit with Bobby Darin, and, he and I had that natural instinct to go that way, and we'd say, we want to be like them. And, one of my earlier albums was called Swings for Young Lovers, and it was an album of all old standards with a big swing band, which was very unusual. And then Darin did his, and I realized that that's where I wanted to go if I had to survive. And, with my management and agents, all of a sudden I was the youngest kid to work the Copa. Then I was the youngest kid to work Vegas in 59 with Sophie Tucker. And I started to say, yeah, I think I can survive if I learn my craft and I become a performer. And that's what I pursued. And I really started to sense the foundation broadening, which was going to allow me to maybe sustain myself, because I felt that people were looking at me different, not only as the writer, but this performer and this kid that put this tux on. And then Darin became successful with Mac the Knife. So it really looked like we were on the right course. And then we started to merge with Sinatra. And there I was working with them and learning from them and being around these guys. And that was the final goal for us. And then the Beatles came and changed everything.
When you started hanging out with Sinatra and the other guys in the Rat Pack, what were some of the things about their lives that you wanted to emulate, and other things about their lives that you wanted to make sure to avoid?
Yeah, for sure. You're enamored and flattered being around them and being accepted by them. You certainly weren't one of them, but you were on the periphery, but also allowed in. And you like their sense of style. You like the way they dressed. You certainly like the music. You like the way that they sang. You like the way they performed. For a while, you started getting the habits of, they teach you how to play blackjack. Okay, if you don't lose a lot of money. You watch them drink and smoke. Life is choices. And I looked and saw what it did to them and saw how they suffered from it. And went, I'm not going to be the smoker, and I'm just not going to drink the hard liquor, because I need to function. I want to be in control of what I'm doing. So you learn, you know, both sides of that, what to do and what not to do. But it was very exciting to be around. It was a big learning college for me.
Did Sinatra treat you like the kid?
Yeah, I was the kid. You know, everybody, we all had our robes in this famous steam room that we all hung out in. And Dino was the dag. Joy Bishop had a robe, which was one of his sayings, like, you know, what do you think about that? I forget what it was. Sammy was Smokey the Bear, and mine was the kid, and that's what Frank called me, the kid.
And did that seem affectionate to you, or did you feel like you wanted to grow up and not be the kid anymore?
No, I was I was the kid. I was younger. He was very affectionate about it. I liked it. You know, I called him the old man, ultimately. You know, you got with the program. I never, you know, I never felt in any way inferior. I was certainly younger. You know, I was just sitting there watching this incredible candy store unfold in front of me, from JFK showing up and Marilyn Monroe and all these stars, and, you know, all the activity and all the little boy antics.
You know, we were talking about your friendship with Sinatra and some of the things that you learned from him. You wrote the English lyric for the song that became his anthem, My Way. The song pre-existed, but it was a French song with a French lyric, a lyric that was totally different from your English lyric. Mm-hmm. How did you first hear the song, and what made you want to write a new lyric for it?
Well, as I said earlier, I was very much into the whole European culture, and I started spending a lot of time in Europe. I'd gotten married there in Paris and brought my children every year to the south of France to a house that I had down there that we rented. And I was down in Mougins, which is just a little village south of France, and I was listening to the radio and listening to all of these, you know, modern songs and knowing where they fit. I heard this melody on the radio, and I said, there's something more to that. I'd like to get my hands on it. So I called a friend of mine in Paris who I was in business with a publishing company. And he said, yeah, I know the guy that has the song, and it's, you know, it's not that big a hit, but what do you want? I said, just give it to me, the rights. He said, fine. He said, I'll call the guy. So I flew up to Paris, and I met with him, and they gave it to me. I mean, there was no money changed hands.
There was no money?
Nothing. There was no work buying the pyramids, nothing. It was real simple, a couple of pages, a piece of paper, and I took this song. I just took it from that form, and I started playing it on the piano into the vibe that I heard. And it was just more classical and structured. And fade in, I'm in Florida, Sinatra calls, and he said, let's have dinner. I'm doing this movie down here, but let's have dinner tonight. I'll come and see your show. We have dinner. He said, kid, I'm doing one more album with Costin. I'm quitting the business. I'm fed up. I'm getting out. And, you know, he'd been really hassled. Things were going on in his life that he didn't like, and he wanted to quit. So that really moved me. You know, one more album, I'm out of the business. Sinatra, can't believe it. I go back to New York, where I was living at the time, and I started typing. And I said, now, if Sinatra were writing this, you know, what would he say? And I started, and now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain, da-da. And it started to write itself. And I called he and Don Costa, who at the time were out at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. And I said, guys, I've got something for the album, and I just, you need to hear this. And about a few months later, I got a call, knowing that they were in the studio, and Sinatra was on the phone, and he was in L.A., I'm in New York. He said, kid, listen to this. And he put the phone up to the speaker, and that was the first time that I heard Frank Sinatra singing My Way. And I just started to cry. It was just the most emotional moment for me, because I'd never really written anything like that, let alone have Frank Sinatra be the messenger of such, you know, a different song in what was going on back then in the late 60s.
Well, why don't we hear Frank Sinatra singing My Way with a lyric by my guest, Paul Anka.
Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do, saw it through without exemption. I planned each charted course, each careful step
along the byway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Yes, there were times, I'm sure you knew, when I bit off more than I could chew. But through it all, when there was doubt, I ate it up and spit it out. I faced it all and I stood tall and did it my way. I've loved.
One more thing in the annals of Paul Anka lore. And this is a website that you probably really hate. I'm sure you know about it. There's a website called The Guys Get Shirts that features...
Oh, yeah, I love it. It's great.
It features a really long tirade where you're bawling out your band. This was recorded a few years ago, probably surreptitiously.
15 years ago by a real snake that we fired after a month that brought a tape machine in. In fact, we had a nice big moment on it with Howard Stern recently.
Oh, did he play it?
Oh, yeah, he played it, and he listened. He absolutely agreed with it. And he said, look, I've done that. I do that. And everybody does, you know. I mean, I think that any guy running a company gets it. The whole point of that tape, you know, I'm a real stickler for detail, and I have a real strong respectability and responsibility to my audience. And when I'm up on that stage, and anything that I do, it's got to be as perfect as possible for the consumer, for whomever. You know, I don't go to work at night and take the check and run. So what was happening there was a lot of mistakes in the band, in the sense that we'd rehearsed it one way, and then when you have a cutoff or you're doing something, everyone has to end together. And the other was that we'd gone, spent a lot of money on getting guys dressed so that there was uniformity, and whether it was for the TV show or whatever it was. And guys just drop the ball. You know, a lot of musicians, some of them are drinkers and some of them are doing dope and what have you, and you learn that, you know, later in the gig. It's like hiring people. You know, the resumes are one thing and everybody's on their best behavior, but until you get somewhere into the voyage and realize that, you know, you've got some bad apples in there, that's when you have to deal with it. And, yeah, it's a funny tape. You know, listen, that's me, and... I'm that way, you know. People don't toe the line; they're out.
Well, you really lay into the band on this, and you say things. When I effing move, I slice like an effing hammer. And right. What's it like to really bawl out your band, and then be in front of them in a performance? Because when it comes time to perform, you want that band to be really sympathetic, and you want them to play in a moving way. So,
they do. They don't even take light of it. And we're having dinner together on Saturday night. It's totally meaningless because they're used to that environment. They've done it with Buddy Rich. They've heard it with Sinatra. You know, these are seasoned guys that really, when you show them those mistakes and you ball them out any way you want, they know the personality and the other side of the person. I mean, I've heard, Tommy Lasorda. I mean, there's like thousands of these tapes out there from Orson Welles to Lasorda. And I think we're all indoctrinated with that and get it. So a band... when you're giving them work, and most of those guys are still with me today, you know, they know the personality, they know when they're wrong, they know how to decipher and edit what all of that is, and it really doesn't come to play whatsoever. I mean, when you're doing this 47 years and you're successful on that stage, every entity is working and all the energies are working. And the other side of the coin is, you know, you're the guy that's loaning the money, that you're doing this for their families, that you're bringing them here. So you got to look at the full mosaic. This is not anything new here. This is a small pebble on the whole infrastructure of business where people hear it. I know how to motivate people and how to treat them, and I've been doing that for years, so I have absolutely no regrets for anything on that whatsoever.
Paul Anka, speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. His latest CD, Classic Songs My Way, came out last year.